the ones, and that's it. 1:45, thank you very much for getting back on time. We have a very interesting session, and it's of much interest for you all, as of course it's for us as well, is the working together, how we envisage the future working with standard setters around the globe. With more than 120 countries adopting IFRS, it's very important for us to enhance this relationship with you all. And I guess, as I told you in the morning, for the ones who are aware of the Mayan prophecy, lots of changes are happening. And Hans, Yael, Mike, and Sonia will bring you some good news on this topic. Just one kind reminder for observers. Mostly during the breakout sessions and the discussions, we expect the observers not to participate actively in the discussion, directing questions and during the debate. So we kindly ask the observers to refrain from actively engaging discussion during the presentation. Of course, in breakout, during the break, coffee break, we are all welcome to continue interacting with us. So with that, I'll hand over to Hans.
Yes, good afternoon. Welcome back from the lunch. Was quite good, the lunch, I thought, if I may say so. I hope it didn't make you too sleepy, because this is going to be an interesting session. Amaro just said 120 countries are adopting IFRS. This morning I said over 100 countries are using IFRS, among which two-thirds of the G20. But what are we really talking about? Whenever I travel around the world, I ask people, how are you exactly applying IFRS? And I hear very interesting anecdotal information. I hear about countries that have adopted IFRS as it was in 2009, but since have not adapted to new changes. Other countries, for example, Mexico is a full adopter of IFRS, yet not for the insurance industry and the banking industry. I just hear from Syria this morning that they apply IFRS across the board in their country. But the fact is that we only have anecdotal information and not really reliable information. And we think that we would like to know, but it's also important for investors to know, what is the situation around the world. And that's why we did a survey. And today, Yael and Sonia, no. Sonia. Are going to present that survey, and it's also going to be interesting for me because they assumed I had seen it, but of course they have taken all the decisions without me, and I haven't seen the survey myself either. I understand there is quite some expectation that this morning in my speech I mentioned the fact that we are going to set up a mechanism to work more closely with national standard setters, a technical advisory function, a technical advisory committee. I think there is expectations that we were going to give a presentation on that either, on that too. That is not going to happen this afternoon, but I can tell you that within a week or two, we will send out a written proposal. We will publish it on the internet with the specificities of our proposal, and you are all invited and also encouraged to react. We'll have a consultation period, and we would really like to know what you think about it and how you think it could be improved, our proposal. So with that, I give the floor to Yael, and she's going to start a presentation. I'm going to sit over there so that I can see.
Actually, we had distributed and circulated a survey with you, and Sonia has analyzed it, so we will start with the presentation with Sonia first, so we can see the first findings of the survey, and then we'll start the interactive session. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So thank you, first of all, I think, to all of you, because most of you, as I understand, have participated in the survey, and The ones that haven't, please feel free to contribute, even after that session. So the more the merrier, and we hope to get eventually all countries' jurisdictions around the world input from. How did the survey come about? Well, the 2011 trustee strategy asked the organization to seek an understanding on the application of IFRS around the world. And in response to that, we sat together with a group in the organization and tried to find out a way to do that appropriately. So as a result, we initiated the survey in August this year among the world standard setting community. And the survey closed on October the 15th. As I said before, even though it's formally closed, we still hope to get more contributions because we have a large number of countries, but certainly not all countries around the world. What were our objectives? Well, Hans already mentioned some. They were threefold. First of all, of course, we wanted to gain a better understanding what is actually happening. Currently, we have a good picture. As Hans said, some is anecdotal, or we sort of know it, but we wanted to hear your views on that. And it was also important to us not to give a black and white picture, but to provide a differentiated view of the different circumstances and pathways that every jurisdiction has to adoption and endorsement of IFRS. Secondly, we also wanted to address a gap that currently exists, because if you come to our website, for instance, and you want to understand who actually uses IFRS around the world, well, you will find a preliminary assessment of the G20 countries, but not much more, and so you have to refer to third parties. That is not ideal, and so we hope that the survey and the results will also address that and provide an authoritative source that provides your information in a structured manner. And lastly, it's also a help for us to help you better, because the organization has said it wants to make every effort to understand where we can do more and what we can do better. How have we done the survey? The survey had three parts. The first of all was about whether and how IFRS have been adopted, so is there commitment, how has this been put in practice. The second related to questions around endorsement mechanisms and other matters such as translations and contractual arrangements. And lastly, also, we wanted to understand a bit more about the use of IFRS around the world. What were our assumptions? So I have to tell you, given that the deadline closed was only on 15th of October, of course, we could only do a preliminary analysis. That is important to mention because, as I said before, it was important for us to get a full picture. So every question that we ask for further additional comments to make sure we really understand you well. And as it happens, sometimes, obviously, there were misunderstandings, the questions were interpreted slightly differently. So all these things need to be looked at in detail, and that will, of course, follow. For the time being and for that analysis, we have taken the contributions at face value. What were the key observations? So there are six key observations that I will shortly mention. First of all is a very basic but very important observation, that the majority of jurisdictions are committed to IFRS, and they have this commitment made public. On top of that, as you can see from the participating jurisdictions by region, this commitment is widespread around the world. We had responses from 71 jurisdictions, including the EU, and 90% of the G20 countries participated to date. Overall, out of these commitments, 96 have stated that they are publicly committed to IFRS. And that is important because if we look at this percentage already, those that have responded present already 65% of the global GDP, so it is an important economic force. And the majority of those that are committed are actually already allowing or requiring the use for domestic companies. The 35% that are outstanding should not be taken as the ones that are not on board. They're simply the ones that haven't responded yet. So, secondly, we also wanted to understand where are people, the jurisdictions, not the people, of course, on the pathway to IFRS. So we ask at which stage is your jurisdiction in the process towards the adoption of IFRS. And on that question, 84% answered they have already adopted. As you can see, 9% said they are converging with a set timetable. Others were 4%, and 3% skipped the question. Here, for instance, you can see I need to classify because of those that said they are converging. Actually, if you look at their comments, the majority of them are already using the IFRS. So this is what I meant, we need to have a detailed analysis. But it shows us already that the most mainly jurisdictions are not only committed, but they have put this commitment into practice. And in addition to understanding whether jurisdictions are actually using it, we also wanted to understand how they are using it. So we can see that over 90% of those that are committed to IFRS already require the use of IFRSs for at least some of their domestic companies. And among those that are already permitting or requiring IFRSs, all permit and require also the use of IFRS for foreign companies. Now, this is also an example where the question was interpreted slightly differently from some. So some understood our question as if we were asking for all domestic companies and not only for listed companies. So when some answered required for some, they actually qualified in their additional comments that they are requiring IFRSs for all listed companies. So this is what I mentioned. And an interesting observation that the answer to this question and the additional comments gave was that a number of jurisdictions are actually requiring IFRSs for more than just publicly listed companies, and that's something that will be discussed later on by Mike and Yael, for instance. So the key observation here is IFRSs are, in the majority of cases, a requirement and not an option, and that is, I think, quite an important statement. Then, obviously, it is also interesting what sort of IFRSs are being used. We ask two types of questions on that matter. First of all, we ask what IFRSs have been adopted. IFRSs as issued by the ISB, IFRSs with some options eliminated or with some minor modifications. And the questionnaire also qualified that minor modifications means that the resulting financial statements could be, in a majority of cases, still be in full compliance with IFRS. And if we look at the combined answer of these two, we can see that the majority of jurisdictions are using IFRS as issued by the ISB, and this is confirmed by the footnote or the auditor's statement. The 30 that have the minor modifications, these are the 27 EU countries. There's one EU accession country and a candidate country, an EC country and a candidate country. So effectively, this represents the EU spectrum. So by and large, IFRSs are issued as issued by the ISB, and this is confirmed through the auditor's statement. Now, an important factor also is obviously to understand what are the different endorsement mechanisms, what do countries do to actually incorporate new IFRSs. The key observation here was endorsement mechanisms exist in most jurisdictions. However, they differ a lot in style and focus. And that is a topic that will be further explored in the discussion later on as well, because it doesn't lend to a simple quantification. So the answer, endorsement mechanism, yes or no, will not help you any further a lot. What we do know is that the endorsement mechanisms take place on a range, so from direct implementation into the legal framework to active independent deliberations on a standard-by-standard basis on the other scale. And the different foci are around translation, for instance. Other countries focus on how the ISB complied with its due process and its governance structures, and others focus on actual technical aspects that have, for instance, independent committees that provide endorsement advice. And this is something that we will discuss later. Then we also wanted to ask, obviously, about contractual arrangements and translations. And contractual arrangements, the questions around here were, has your jurisdiction a contractual arrangement with IFRS, for instance, yes or no, and further explanation. And that area just reflected how much importance we put on intellectual property rights, because as you all will understand, safeguarding the IFRS brand is in the interest of all jurisdictions that have adopted IFRSs. What is very positive here is that the majority of those jurisdictions that said they are already using IFRSs, they are in a contractual relationship with us. And in those cases where it's not the case, we need to look into further detail what are the reasons for that, and this is what will be as a follow-up with the jurisdictions. Also to note is that only about 50% actually require translations of IFRS into the local language. And the majority of those that require translations are already working in cooperation with the IFRS Foundation translation function. Also, that is a very good, very reassuring, I think, outcome of the survey. We also were interested in understanding if there are other issues or challenges related to translation, but the feedback on those areas was limited. So this may be, we need to see that, a matter of further discussions or further follow-up queries. Lastly, obviously, as I mentioned at the beginning, we also wanted to understand how is the IFRS for SMEs doing in that picture. Now, what we could clearly see is that there's growing use of the IFRS for SMEs. Fully used is the IFRS for SMEs by 16 jurisdictions that answered. Only 2 said they use it, but with modifications, and 23 said no, at the moment they are not using it. However, that no needs a qualification, because out of those, more than the half said they are considering currently the adoption of the IFRS for SMEs. So this is quite a positive picture. Lastly, what can we summarize from these observations? There is widespread use of IFRSs. It represents a powerful force in the global economy. It is in most cases mandatory in application for domestic listed entities, and most often in accordance with IFRS as issued by the ISB. We will require obviously a further analysis regarding the detail of the application and endorsement mechanisms. And lastly, the use of IFRS seems to broaden across entities. What will be our next step? As I said, we need to do a detailed analysis of each submission. Where we require clarifications, we will be in touch with you. And we will then also present the full findings to you on a question-by-question basis. Lastly, we will consider the development of sort of jurisdictional profiles that would be owned by the jurisdictions and posted on the IFRS website, and that relates to this gap filling that I mentioned at the beginning as one of the objectives. And obviously, all that we learn from you is also helpful for us to do our work better and will be considered as part of our strategic planning. And before I hand over to Mike and Yael, I just want to I point you to interesting material that was recently published, and that is a study that Anne Tarka has undertaken on behalf of the IFRS Foundation that sets out and analyses existing research on the benefits and impacts of the adoption of IFRS. So that is available on our website if you are interested. We may also send it around to you. And with that, I hand over to you.
Thank you, Sonia. Now, the way we want to structure this session is to have it in 2 parts. The longer part would be an interactive part where we asked some of you, selected participants, to answer based on the answers you provided in a survey. Our aim in this part of the session is to give everybody else a sense or a flavor of how IFRSs are used around the world, what are the different adoption and endorsement mechanisms that existed, and we think this is an information that can assist all of us together for jurisdictions that are considering to adopt IFRS. It will give some alternatives to think about and some considerations that other jurisdictions have faced. And for us, it's very, very important, first of all, just to flesh a bit some of the things that we've encountered in the survey. And as Sonia said and pointed out, this is a very important step in us planning the future and us planning and how working with national standard setters around the world. The reason why we thought national standard setters would be the first point of contact on this is because we really want to create this database that will serve the international community. And in the second part of this session, it would be very interesting that you comment both on what you hear from each other, but also if you have any sort of comments to us on how to use this information best, how to present it to you that in a way that will be helpful, and how to engage you in having an updated source of information about IFRS around the world and how it is used, that would be really helpful for us to just implement what we've learned in the survey and how to present it and use it for the benefit of all of us. So we will start by covering some, not all, of the issues that came up in the survey. And the first issue that we'd like to touch on is the extent of IFRS use, that is the coverage of IFRS in different countries. The survey aimed to understand how and in which cases IFRS are used in different jurisdictions, and it resulted in showing us that a number of countries share the same challenge of having the existence of two or sometimes even three accounting standards for exchange-listed entities in the same market. And this is an interesting situation that we want to explore more now with three representatives from Japan, the US, and Switzerland. So we have a same situation, but it was caused in each country for a different reason. We start by Japan, Atsu Kato. Japan allows optional or voluntary use of IFRS for some domestic companies only, and the result that in Japan we have three sets of accounting standards, the local, US GAAP, and IFRS. And what we would like to, if you could share with us, is the rationale for this decision, and given Japan's general commitment to IFRS, how does the market as a whole addresses this challenge of three accounting standards at the same time? And if you can please answer this difficult question in 3 minutes, that will be great.
Okay, thank you, Yael. Within 3 minutes, I have to explain many things. But yes, you are right. In the Japanese market, beside the Japanese GAAP, US GAAP is allowed only for about three major companies which shares are listed on New York Stock Exchange. It was decided many years ago, maybe more than 20 years ago at that time. It is still, you know, lasting that practice. And also we, from 2010, we started to allow voluntarily to apply IFRS only for the primarily large corporations which have operations outside Japan. So you are right, we have, you know, three different accounting standards. However, it may be too much emphasized or amplified about this. But in Japan, we don't have, I think, you know, we don't have any confusions or comparability problems, although we have three standards. There are three reasons for that why I can say it is, first of all, Japanese GAAP have been already substantially converged with IFRS, except for recently issued IFRS such as IFRS 9, 10, 11, 13, or a partial amendment of IAS 19. We haven't done yet. However, other than those, we have already substantially converted. So major differences now from IFRS would be such as amortization of goodwill with still require periodical amortization of goodwill together with the impairment test. And then we have a non-capitalization of internally generated development cost, and then non-capitalization of borrowing cost. Those may be the major differences. And then very sophisticated professional users, especially financial analysts, made an adjustment to those, you know, differences so that they don't feel any inconvenience, and then they don't have any comparability issues. Second reason for that is still small number of companies voluntarily have adopted IFRS. That is less than 10 companies so far. And then as far as the US GAAP is concerned, only 30 companies. So out of 3,600 listed companies in Japan, in terms of number, those are about only 1%. Even though we consider capitalization of those companies, that might be, could be just 5% or so. So still very small, you know, companies have IFRS and the US GAAP. And then a third reason might be in Japan, apart from consolidated financial statement, separate financial statement, which is, you know, standalone statement of a parent company. This is also published together with the consolidated financial statement, and all of those separate financial statements are prepared under the Japanese GAAP because of tax requirement and the Companies Act, so that still Japanese GAAP financial statements are majority in our capital market, so that even we use, say, a three standard, but majority's effect in capital market is still Japanese GAAP.
Thank you very much. Our next respondent is Tom Linsmeyer from the U.S. Tom, in 2009, the U.S. allowed foreign companies to raise capital in the U.S. using IFRS as issued by the IASB. Again, this is a situation where we have two existing accounting standards, U.S. GAAP and IFRS. And we would like to know how the U.S. addresses that same challenge of having two systems in parallel.
Thanks, Yale. Actually, there's more than two systems in the U.S. because if foreign private issuers come to the United States and either follow home GAAP or IFRS not as issued by the ISB, they're still subject to the 20F reconciliation requirement. And that 20F reconciliation requirement requires reconciliation of equity and net income from home GAAP to U.S. GAAP. So there were, before the relaxation of the 20F reconciliation requirement in the United States, multiple types of GAAP that were permitted within our markets with very limited reconciliation, and those reconciliations occurred on a delayed basis. So there's original filing under home GAAP for foreign private issuers, and the 20F sometimes came out months after that. So actually the decision in 2009 to permit companies not to reconcile if they come to, the foreign private issuers come to U.S. markets using IFRS as issued by the IASB, improved things in our markets in terms of the information set available for users related to foreign private issuers in two significant ways. First, IFRS is a complete and high-quality system that has a lot of comparability but not obviously identical to U.S. GAAP. But instead of getting reports from foreign private issuers that were home GAAPed with very limited delayed recognition, reconciliation, now users were getting complete sets of GAAP, a complete system, fully filed on a timely basis. So all I can observe is the decision in 2009 improved information for users in our markets, but it's still, we're still dealing with three sets or more of potential information that exists in our markets at this time.
Thank you, Tom. We move to Switzerland. Philip, we understand that some Swiss companies like Nestle and others were amongst the earliest to use international accounting standards. the IASs, and Switzerland accepts today the use of IFRSs for companies listed on the stock exchange in addition to the local Swiss GAAP. What is the rationale for that decision, and what are your experiences so far in these existing two accounting standards in parallel?
We even have one standard more, that's US GAAP. So why do we have the variety of three standards, IFRS as issued by the ISB, US GAAP, and Swiss GAAP FAIR? So just because we believe there is no concept like one size fits all, there are different sizes needed. I would say for the capital market, it's an extra large, a large, and a medium size. Traditionally, we are having the extra large filers, the FPIs, who are still listed in the US, applying US GAAP. Then traditionally we had a high percentage of IAS or IFRS filers due to the fact that the Swiss legal framework just narrows it down to basic principles and leaves it up to the preparer what standard to use. And then we also came to the conclusion that for small and medium-sized entities, US GAAP and IFRS might not be appropriate. We should provide them with a own solution, a tailor-made solution. It's an SME solution, tailor-made for Switzerland. And we are quite happy also being able to provide a regulated segment on the National Stock Exchange, allowing those companies, these SME companies, to apply the standard. It's a standard that really goes down on principles but tries to follow the IFRS principles and has a lot less disclosures than the full IFRSs. So what the future will bring will on one hand depend to which degree IFRS and US GAAP will at one day converge. On the other hand, we will see how it develops on for the SMEs, if we can keep pace with the developments within the IFRSs, and also refrain big multinational companies from applying this standard.
Thank you. I now turn to Mike.
Thanks very much, El. And sticking with the theme of looking at the use of IFRS, we notice a lot of countries around the world require IFRS for listed companies, so Australia, South Africa, the European Union. And then we see some countries in the world extending the use of IFRS, full IFRS, to other entities as well. And we'd just like to ask Brazil and Canada their rationale for doing that, to whom they've extended it to. So if we could start with Brazil, please, Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mike. Perhaps I could start by telling you a very short story. Back in 2003, the predecessor of Hans went to Brazil as chairman of the ISB for the first presentation on this initiative, and we gathered together a number of meetings, one of them with the CFO of very large Brazilian companies. When he finished presenting the case and stating why ISB was engaged in that effort, the CFO of a very large multi-billion dollar company said, thank you very much. I'm sick and tired of filing my financial statements in 10 stock exchanges under 10 different GAAPs. And so the basic reason for Brazil to move towards converging to IFRS, not only in the consolidated statements, but also in the individual statements, were twofold. First, to reduce transaction costs. And second, to adopt a truly robust set of accounting standards for use in the worldwide capital markets.
Just sticking with Brazil for a moment, we noticed in the response that you gave that people used to be able to file in your country from certain neighboring countries with reconciliation to Brazilian GAAP at that time. We noticed that that reconciliation requirement has been removed and that people must now use IFRS. So perhaps if I could just ask the Securities Commission representative, Jorge, to comment on that, please.
Okay. Thank you very much. Regarding to your question, I'd like to talk briefly about cross-listing in the ambit of Mercosul. In 1994, Brazil signed an agreement, a Mercosul agreement, that, among other things, dealt with cross-listing. According to this decision, every company located in a Mercosul country, in order to raise capital in a cross-listing process, had two alternatives in terms of presenting its financial statements. Presenting a financial statement complying with domestic GAAP and a reconciliation requirement, or presenting financial statements complying with IFRS. Okay? Brazil, as a member of Mercosul, had a commitment to internalize this decision in its jurisdiction. In 2008, we changed our corporate law. We put in the law our commitment with convergence process. By this change, every Brazilian publicly held company since then must present its financial statements complying with IFRS. So this was one thing that CVM was not comfortable considering the Mercosul rule. So we put in Mercosul agenda our intention to change the decision in order to avoid this alternative for Mercosul companies. And then in 2011, we've changed the decision, the 1994 decision, and from now, from 2011, every company, not just Brazilian public health company, but every company must comply with IFRS. I think this is something that it's better for us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We will now move to Canada. And in Canada, we understand that IFRS can be used for unlisted companies and that it can be used for not-for-profit entities. Gord, could you explain the rationale behind that decision in Canada to us?
Sure, Mike. And like Atsu, I'm trying to describe a spider's web in 3 minutes. What we discovered, knew, is that Canadian securities legislation, prudential legislation, corporations legislation, and thousands of contracts refer to a term, quote, generally accepted accounting principles, end quote, and say, thou shalt prepare your financial statements in accordance with GAAP. There's generally a definition of GAAP that, with slight variations in the words, generally says GAAP is defined to be the standard set out in the handbook of the Canadian Institute of Chartered Accountants, full stop. One would think that's fairly simple, but then some of the legislation, securities legislation, some corporations legislation, but not prudential legislation, then permits a free choice of companies registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission to use U.S. GAAP. The reference to the handbook of the Canadian Institute of Chartered Accountants, you would think is simple, but there's actually four of them. There is a public sector accounting board in Canada that issues standards for governments and government-controlled entities in both of Canada's official languages, French and English. My board controls the handbook that deals with everything in the private sector, also in French and English. We have defined Canadian GAAP for private enterprises into four buckets. And the first bucket is entities that are publicly accountable. And we have taken the definition of publicly accountable out of IFRS for SMEs, which you'll find quite ironic in just a moment. We have stated that publicly accountable enterprises shall use IFRS as contained in the CICA handbook. We are an endorsement jurisdiction, so we adopt IFRSs standard by standard. Our policy is to adopt IFRSs without modification, and to date, the nine members of my board have voted in favor of no modifications all the way through to IFRS 13. The second bucket is for private enterprises for profit. They are permitted to use something cleverly called accounting standards for private enterprises, which is a variation of old Canadian GAAP with some very interesting accounting policy choices they can make, such as consolidate or not consolidate, taxes payable or full deferred taxes. Those entities have an absolutely free choice to also use IFRS in Part 1 of our handbook. And the reason that we permitted that choice is we have some enormous private companies that would like to benchmark themselves against other IFRS reporting issuers around the world, and a second group of companies that ultimately believe that they will do an initial public offering and go public. Canadian securities law would require that they issue an initial public offering document using IFRS-compliant financial statements. That group of companies, if they want to claim compliance with Canadian GAAP, are prohibited from using IFRS for SMEs. The third bucket is private sector not-for-profit organizations. We have a section of our handbook that sets out the accounting standards that are unique to not-for-profit type of transactions, such as contributions, to the extent that they have to deal with accounting principles that are not unique to not-for-profit. They refer to our private company standards. They also have an absolutely free choice to use IFRS. The thought being there might be some Canadian affiliates of internationally based not-for-profit organizations that use IFRS around the world, and we didn't see any reason to prohibit them from using IFRS if they so wish. The fourth bucket is pension plans, and we have prohibited pension plans from using IS 26. We have a separate standard for them, but ironically, we have scoped in the disclosure requirements of IFRS 7 and the measurement principles of IFRS 13. In the public sector, that public sector handbook deals with governments and government-controlled enterprises. There is a subsection in there called government business enterprises. The public sector board has decided to mandate that those enterprises must use our standards in part one of our handbook, which is IFRS. So that is the whole spider's web of legislation in Canada.
Thank you, Gordon. Your answer was an introduction to the next subject, which is the endorsement of IFRS, as we heard about Canada. But actually, one of the parts that we put an emphasis on in the survey was the different endorsement mechanisms that are used around the world. And the survey actually showed a very wide variety of mechanisms to allow IFRS into national and jurisdictions. And the range is between almost automatic or no endorsement at all and to a processes that include very extensive endorsement procedures. So we start with the no endorsement countries. Start with Mexico. Ricardo, we have learned that IFRSs are applied to all listed companies that are not financial entities, and that there is no endorsement mechanism. So companies actually apply directly IFRSs as used by the ISB, and we want to understand the rationale for your decision on that.
Okay. As a background, I only want to say that in 2008, we decided to require all public companies to prepare their financial statements in accordance with IFRS. And this obligation began in 2012, this year, and the process has been successful. The reason for us to accept the IFRS, to fully accept the IFRS, is because we think that this is the best way for Mexican companies to be compared with other companies around the world. And also, we think that is the best way that foreign companies are listed in Mexico, So, and another reason is that we think that at this moment is there are a lot of ways to discuss with the JASB their all the IFRS. So we think that the better way is to adopt fully. The only companies that are not required to prepare their financial information in accordance with IFRS are the financial entities, as you said. And in the case of the foreign companies that are listed in Mexico, they can prepare their financial information with IFRS, but they can also do it with US GAAP and with their home GAAP, but they have to prepare a reconciliation to IFRS.
Thank you. We moved to South Africa. South Africa recently changed the companies law and requires now an automatic endorsement of IFRSs and IFRSs for SMEs for particular entities. And we would like to understand from Ludolf, what is the rationale for the change in the framework of endorse or non-endorsing IFRS, and if you can briefly also outline your system of public interest score, which is very unique and interesting.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes, I think it's important to indicate that since 1995 already, South Africa realized that from a capacity and a resource perspective to start following international standards. And so as early as 1995, we were harmonizing with the international standards. But in 2003, as a country, the standard setter agreed to issue IFRSs without amendment, but there was an endorsement process. So previously there was an endorsement standard by standard that was required, but there was no changes, and it was literally issued for the Companies Act. What has happened is there's been reforms to change the Companies Act and the legal legislation, and through that we have lobbied to have legal backing for the accounting standards, and thankfully, the government saw the need to put that in, and it refers directly now in the Companies Act to IFRS or IFRS for SMEs as issued by the ISB. And in doing so, they decided to set that up on a tabular basis based on a company's public interest score. And a public interest score is then calculated for all the companies based on point system of number of employees, they call it turnover, not revenue, and third-party liabilities, and the number of shareholders. And based on your public interest score, it then prescribes for you which financial reporting framework you are permitted to use. There is still a choice. However, for listed companies, listed on the stock exchange, and the large, the state-owned enterprises, they are required to use IFRS as issued by the ISB. That, I think, also comes from the fact that way back in 2005, our listed our stock exchange required that for listed companies, and that was, I think, yes, to play in the global market, attract foreign investment to the country. So we have that. Then on the public interest score, going down, depending on whether you're publicly accountable and your point system, 350, and then below, above 350, below 350, and below 100. Essentially, you have the option of IFRS or IFRS for SMEs. Below 100, there's no requirement, and you can use your own accounting policies, and that is to sort of make things simpler. So I hope that answers.
Indeed. Thank you very much. We move now to the next category. Those are countries in which endorsement follows a process of advice and consultation, and finally, word-by-word endorsement decision. So we want to know better, understand that better. We already know the EU, so we decided not to ask a European country this time, but focus on a new joiner. Russia, Leonid Schneidman. We understand that, like the EU, Russia has recently adopted IFRS endorsement process, which is similar to the EU, and we would like to know the rationale for that decision, and how do you identify the main benefit and main challenge in this mechanism?
Thank you. The Russian endorsement mechanism was introduced in year 11 and was tested during endorsement of the full set of IFRS in force as on January 1st, 12, as well as further development in IFRS made in year 2012. I do not think that this mechanism and everything related to it in Russia are very different from other jurisdictions. The ultimate purpose of the endorsement mechanism in Russia is to legalize IFRS according to Russia's legal framework. Based on this objective, I would mention two main reasons for the introduction of the endorsement mechanism. Let me call one of them political and the second one legal. Under the Russian legislation, the whole area of accounting and financial reporting is under the responsibility of the Russian Federation. This area is considered as one of the safeguards for the national market and even broader as sort of guarantee for the right for the market participants on the financial information. We can even talk about element of country sovereignty when we consider the accounting standards. This is the political reason to have country endorsement mechanism. The second legal reason is about status of the IFRS within the Russian legal system. In order to interested parties to protect their rights in terms of the accuracy and reliability of the financial statements, the IFRS should be legal document regulations. This required the IFRS are an integral part of the legal system without any contradictions to other laws and regulations. Because of this, the second reason for the endorsement mechanism is to check the consistency of the IFRS with other legislation. The main benefits from the endorsement, from the country endorsement mechanism, is the real involvement of the business and professional communities into the accounting field. In addition, this mechanism encourages the Russian business, professions, and regulators to be more active with vis-à-vis ISB. The main challenge, timeless and neutralizing of the lobbying efforts of some interested parties. Another challenge relates to the potential conflict of interest in the situation when the endorsement process and the standard setting process are kept together under the same house. The potential for conflicts of interest is addressed by, first of all, fixing clear criteria for endorsement, and secondly, setting strict due process for endorsement with clear distinguishes between decision making for standard setting and endorsement. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leonid. We move now to New Zealand. New Zealand has a unique negative clearance mechanism of IFRSs. Kimberly Crook, would you please present your system and also explain its rationale and how does it work in practice?
Under our legislation, Financial Reporting Act, there is a legal requirement for certain entities, including listed companies, to prepare their financial statements in accordance with New Zealand GAAP. So that is the legal requirement. New Zealand GAAP has a definition that refers to approved financial reporting standards. So as a consequence of that legislation, we need to have a process whereby we incorporate IFRS into New Zealand financial reporting standards. So we run a due process that essentially mirrors and runs at the same time as the ISB due process. So ISB puts out an exposure draft, we put out an exposure draft, which is basically the ISB document and a New Zealand invitation to comment. At the time when the ISB finalises the standard, we then consider that standard and in all cases so far, we approve that standard and create a New Zealand equivalent standard, which is basically the ISB word-for-word standard with NZ in front of it. And therefore, and that's in accordance with an overall strategy that we have, whereby we want to have our tier, what we call tier one, our top tier publicly accountable for-profit entities, that when they comply with NZ IFRS, they will be simultaneously complying with IFRS, and we have dual compliance statements. So we have the requirement in IFRS 1 to assert compliance with IFRS. We also have a requirement to assert compliance with New Zealand GAAP. So that dual compliance statement appears in the basis of preparation note, and it also appears in the audit report. So the auditors have to give their opinion on whether the accounts comply with New Zealand GAAP and whether they comply with IFRS.
Thank you very much. And finally, we come to South Korea, where there is an endorsement mechanism with a special emphasis on translating the standards. Steve Lim, can you please present us your local framework for endorsing the standards, and specifically explain the process of translating and public deliberation of the process of how you actually endorse the standards into your system. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Yael. For all Korean in GAAP to have the legal authority or to be part of the legal framework, the public deliberation process is required. IFRS adoption means that the IFRSs have to become part of Korean GAAP, so translation of all IFRS has to follow the same extensive deliberation process for setting Korean standards. This due process is called the Korean endorsement process. And the benefits of the extensive due process are that first, Korean constituents understand new and amended IFRS better, and secondly, it makes translations better and have no critical flaws. Challenges may be that the deliberation process requires too much time after ISB's issuance of IFRS. So Korean constituents have less time to prepare for new IFRS standard.
Thanks very much. The next subject is very close to my heart, the IFRS for SMEs, and there was also a section in the survey about the extent of use of the IFRS for SMEs, and then again, with the SME standard, we see lots of variances to whom it is applied in different jurisdictions. Many jurisdictions have made it mandatory, some have made it optional, and some have set thresholds to determine whether you use full IFRS or whether you use the IFRS for SMEs, for example. And one of those jurisdictions is Botswana. And Vijay, if we could just ask you to explain your rationale for adopting the IFRS for SMEs, and then to explain your threshold mechanism, if you would, please. Thank you.
Thank you. To start with, the IFRS is a mechanism which comes through the Companies Act of Botswana, so that way it is a statutory requirement to comply with IFRS. And the framework accommodates the usage of IFRS, IFRS for SMEs, and any local standards which may come up with, which as of date we don't have, and we're working on a micro gap for Botswana at this point of time. Now, in terms of IFRS for SME, the Council of Botswana Institute of Chartered Accountants decided to adopt IFRS SME soon after it was launched in 2009. Basically, based on the Companies Act, the public companies may not apply the IFRS for SMEs, and public interest entities, as defined by the Institute again, may not use IFRS for SMEs. Basically, we just came up with a specific aspect of what is economically significant in Botswana. Those companies cannot apply IFRS for SME, and we just brought in certain categories, which includes net assets, total revenue, number of employees, and third-party borrowings. And if any of the two thresholds are being touched, it automatically gives them an option not to use IFRS for SMEs, and they have to use IFRS. And well, otherwise, it's an optional framework. It is up to the companies to choose to use IFRS for or IFRS for SMEs. Duncan, you want to add?
I think the most interesting part for Botswana is that we start operating from the audit threshold. All the companies that are audited have to comply with FRMs. And if you have got public accountability, then you use full IFRS. If you don't have, you then use FRS for SMEs. So whichever way you look at it, if you are a limited company and you are audited, then you have to comply with IFRS of some sort. And that is within the legal framework, as DVJ has said. So I think that's all I can add.
And including in the listed company space, again, it's compulsory to use IFRS. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the explanations. Another country in Africa that also has a threshold is Tanzania. And we heard South Africa's threshold. Piers Banio, could you just share with us if your threshold is the same for full IFRS and the IFRS for SMEs, or if you have a different way of formulating your threshold?
Okay, thank you very much. Maybe I'll start with the background. In Tanzania, we've got National Board of Accountants Auditors, which is NBAA. It is both the regulatory body and the standard setting body. And for that reason, we are privileged. I think we are privileged that even in our Companies Act, it has been stated categorically in the Act that all private companies are supposed to prepare their accounts according to NBAA pronouncements. And for that reason, we are privileged that once the governing body of NBAA have adopted, for example, we adopted the IFRS in 2004, it is automatically that all companies are supposed to use IFRS because it is in the law. But later, we noted that there are some, after having IFRS for SMEs in 2009, we adopted it. There was some kind of confusion. Should we use IFRS, full IFRS for SMEs? Then, fortunately or unfortunately, from 2003, the government of Tanzania, through the Ministry of Trade, Industry and Trade, they defined what is SME. And when ISB came with the IFRS for SMEs, we say that now we have to compromise. We have to look at the way not to confuse the public by having two definitions of SMEs. For that reason, we went and have the criteria of the capital. We're using capital, the equity capital we have, or number of employees which have been employed, or turnover, total turnover in a year, and also assets. So if you qualify to, as I said previously, either of these two, you are supposed to use full IFRS. Otherwise, you can use the IFRS for SMEs. But we've also managed to convince the public sector, that because to put some provisions, legal provision, in order for us to make sure that we are consistent, whatever NBA, because we are as a regulatory body, we decide, then it is accepted by the public. We have managed to talk with the regulatory bodies, for example, Central Bank of Tanzania, so it is endorsed that all banks have to apply IFRS. And we have differentiated between the public traded account entities and the public interested entity. In Tanzania, we want all public interested entity to use the full IFRS. And also, in the law, as I said, we've managed to put a slot, a provision there that even the President of the United Republic of Tanzania is supposed to appoint Accountant General from NBA members. This also applies to Auditor General. For that reason, both ways, we can talk, and then we are in the public and private sector. We are working together to make sure that we apply IFRS. So all international accounting standards. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. It's interesting to see so many variants of the way different countries set those thresholds. The next section that we wanted to look at was the section that dealt with those countries that are on the road to IFRS, either adopting or converging. And to get an update from them at this meeting about the progress that they are making down the road to IFRS. So we'd like an update on the plans. We'd like to know what the main benefit is that they see in the route that they're taking to IFRS and the main challenge that they have.
In 3 minutes.
So 1 minute per thing. And if we could start, please, with India. And I think, Avinash, if you would do that for us, please.
Thank you very much. India earlier decided to converge with the IFRS from 1st April 2011. But due to certain reason, primarily because of the fact that it was decided to apply the Indian accounting standards converged with IFRS not only to the consolidated financial statements but to also to the separate financial statements. So there were certain tax issues. Because for the purpose of computation of income tax, the standalone financial statements are used. So because of that problem, the application of the Indian accounting standards converged with the IFRS, they were deferred. But there is recently there has been a good news that the Minister of Corporate Affairs, Government of India, has stated that the intention of the government is to converge with the Indian accounting standards from 2013. It may appear to be quite optimistic in the sense that the Indian accounting standards, which we converged in 2011, they were at that time converged with the IFRS in 2011. So therefore, since after 2011, some new IFRS have been issued. So the process is on with regard to issuing the Indian accounting standards, which are converged with the IFRS, which are expected to be in force in 2013. So as per our process, first the Indian accounting standards are finalized by the Institute of Chartered Accountants of India, and thereafter they are approved by one of the government committees which is established under the Companies Act, that is the National Advisory Committee on Accounting Standards, which recommends these Indian accounting standards to the Government of India, which subsequently notifies it in the Companies Act. So as far as the Institute is concerned, we have finalized most of the Indian accounting standards which have recently been issued, that is IFRS 10, 11, 12, not 13. 13 is in the process. It is causing us a little issues, fair value measurement. IFRS 9, we are waiting for the issuance of the final standard by the IASB. And in fact, the government has asked us that when can we be ready with the Indian accounting standards, which are converged with the IFRS. So as far as we are concerned, as I mentioned, that we have no issues. The only problem in giving us the date to the government, that is, when can we expect to issue the Indian accounting standard converged with the IFRS, the major challenge and the, you can say, the concern is that we are not sure about when IFRS 9 will be completed, because today we have the Indian accounting standard corresponding to 39. And as far as the banks and insurance companies are concerned, so they are waiting for the IFRS 9 and the insurance standard for the IASB. So keeping in view all these developments, so at best we can today say is that the most optimistic date can be, say, 2014, but more likely is 2015.
Thanks very much, Avinash. If we could ask Malaysia next, Fayez, if you could just run through the update of where you are and what the main benefit is and what the main challenges that you faced as well.
Thanks, Michael. Where are we? Well, from the 1st of January 2012, Malaysia will have adopted IFRS without carve-outs or deviations. We are also implementing IFRS 1 so that the transition is clearer. The only transitional arrangements we're actually allowing currently is just for the real estate and agriculture industries, pending what ISB finally decides on those two issues. Currently, we're working with the regulators and the big accounting firms to make sure that we can get a clean sign-off at the end of the year that we are IFRS compliant. In terms of the benefits, I think we've had some comments earlier about transactional costs and so on. I think those points which resonate more with us really have to do with Malaysian companies going abroad, where they actually like the idea that they're using a common accounting framework, and also those who are getting a lot of investments in. For some strange reason, we have a lot of Scottish investors in our companies. So having a common framework certainly helps. The other benefit I think we have, which is kind of unique to us, is the fact that we educate a lot of our young abroad. So having a situation where they learn IFRS in the UK and Australia, but not being able to apply it when they come back is a problem. So this hopefully takes up one more reason not to come back. In terms of challenges, I think we have three. The level of knowledge is not equal. We are very reliant on the big accounting firms to get everyone across the line, but we believe that over time, that level of knowledge will balance itself off. The second was getting the buy-in by the key decision makers. We realized there was a lot of misunderstanding as to what IFRS actually meant. So we spent a lot of time trying to explain the why, not the what. And certainly with IFRS's help, that became a lot more easier to explain. And finally, the tax authorities. They live in a world of their own. We're still struggling to try and get them to reduce the reconciliations between accounting and tax profit. Funny enough, we've achieved it in the banking industry, where they've accepted that accounting profit equals tax, but we're still working on the other industries.
Thank you. Thank you for a very interesting update, too. If we could next ask Indonesia for an update on where you are on the road to IFRS, again, where your plans are, what the main benefit or benefits are, and perhaps the main challenges that you focus. Rosita, if you would kindly.
Thank you. Since 2009, Indonesia has made significant progress on IFRS convergence, and as of today, our local accounting standard have converged to IFRS, except for IAS 41 and IFRIC 15, so similar with Malaysia. And it is mandatory for all entities with significant public accountability, including listed companies and their subsidiaries, financial institutions, and state-owned companies. Although we have not decided a date of full IFRS adoption, we will continue minimizing the differences between Indonesian standard and IFRS. And in terms of benefit and challenges, because this is only the first year we converge to IFRS, we cannot say so much, but we are planning to conduct a comprehensive research on the benefit and cost analysis on IFRS implementation in Indonesia next year. 2012 is the first year we use local standard which has substantially similar with IFRS. Therefore, we face significant implementation challenges, especially multi-interpretation issues among users. And we have submitted two discussion papers to IFRIC as the example of IFRS multi-interpretation in Indonesia. One is about accounting for land, and another one is about accounting for telecommunication tower. These two examples have caused debate on the national scale because the size of disputable asset is very significant. And there are many other disputes among practitioners between companies, auditors, and regulators. And we found it is not an easy job for an emerging country like Indonesia in their first year of IFRS convergence to move from rule-based to principle-based accounting standard. To ensure consistent application of accounting for land, for example, Indonesian Accounting Standard Board has issued our local interpretation, which has considered specific land legal framework in Indonesia, and then have to decide to treat the land right as the purchase of PPE, not as a lease and not as intangible asset. But it is only a temporary solution. We are okay locally, but not if an entity is required to have a full compliance to IFRS. There is still a huge diversity on whether it is a lease, intangible asset, or PPE. So therefore, we do believe that there should be a formal communication mechanism between national standard setter and ISB or IFRIC in place to ensure consistent application of IFRS both locally and internationally. If the issue is really, really very specific jurisdiction, which I believe will be very rare circumstances, then there should be a resolution for this. Maybe national standard setter may decide to issue their own interpretation or guidance like what we did now, which need to be considered in compliance with IFRS.
Thanks very much, Rosita. And it is interesting to see the different issues that different countries face on the road to IFRS. And the lessons that can be learned from other people and sharing in a place like the World Standard Setters meeting, I think that is one of the great benefits of this meeting over the years. So we're very pleased that you can share that with us. There's just one related issue that I'd like to have a look at. It was very interesting this year to see two regional associations issue resolutions to adopt IFRS and the IFRS for SMEs throughout their region. And the resolutions basically said that they would encourage member countries to adopt IFRS and the IFRS for SMEs throughout the region. And one of those regions, or representative of one of those regions, is with us today, Andrew Braithwaite from the Institute of Chartered Accountants of the Caribbean. And Andrew, I wonder if you would just share a little bit about that and whether you are promoting or encouraging countries to use particular endorsement mechanisms, or just some information about that might be helpful to the group.
Thank you, Mike. In the Caribbean region, we have an Institute of Caribbean Accountants, Institute of Chartered Accountants of the Caribbean, so ICAP, which sits at the top. But then there are individual territorial institutes, which are all autonomous. ICAC recently formally endorsed IFRS, but this was just a bit of housekeeping. It's just that it was never done before. But all of the individual territorial institutes had for several years already fully adopted IFRS, both full IFRS and now IFRS for SMEs. And adoption of these standards is automatic in virtually all territories. So there's no specific endorsement mechanism that is required or any modification made to the individual standards.
Thank you very much. Thank you all the participants that have agreed to share with us their experience. We now come to the last part of this session, which is the open discussion. First of all, as you could see from the variance of versions of use of IFRS around the world, there's a lot still to explore, and this is the main goal of this survey. So we first encourage any of you who have not filled the survey to please send us the field survey. It's very important to us to know where are you and what we can do to help. And we would be very interested to hear your perspective on what you've just heard, primarily from our point of view, what this information means to the IFRS Foundation and what the best use for us to do. How would you like us to present this? And we would like particularly to be able to work with you on having this information updated so it can help us in our strategy, in our standard setting process, and in everything that we do, because we think this is a gap that needs to be filled. And I think it doesn't only serve us as an organization, it will serve us as a community and all of you. So this is one issue that we're interested to develop in this session. And also, if you have any other questions to the information that you've just heard to us or to each other, to the members, this is now the time to raise your questions. Thank you.
It's not a question, Yael, but I guess I was a little surprised your slide that dealt with the growing use of, I guess maybe it was Sonia, on the IFRS for SMEs, showing that, if I'm understanding it correctly, 23 countries don't use it, and that just seemed to run counter to the impression I had that it was large take-up.
Ah, yes, okay. So in terms of numbers, just to recap that, but we ask, all participants were asked, and in terms of numbers, 16 said they fully use it already, 2 with modifications, and 23 said no. But obviously we need to consider that this is just the people that responded. So my guess was, I didn't say that, but from a lot of countries, and Paul is very good in demonstrating the current status, a lot of jurisdictions that adopted are the ones that are really the smaller jurisdictions and that may not have yet filled in the survey. So this is more a reflection, I think, really of the relationship between the full IFRS and IFRS for SMEs and how jurisdictions deal with that.
Sonia, if I can just clarify one thing on that as well. I understood when you were presenting that of the 23 that were no, there were about half that had indicated an intention to adopt or were in a process of adopting. So I think...
Yes, that's absolute. Oops. Yeah. Well, that's absolutely correct, yeah.
There was a question at the back.
Somebody here. Tricia. Oh. Mike... what I was looking at in earlier on, and Rosita reminded me of it, one of the things that I think would be extremely helpful piece of information that you could find out through the survey that I'm not sure whether you asked the question, at the moment you're asking really whether people have adopted IFRS without modification. That's step one. Step two is there a mechanism in each jurisdiction that permits the local standard setter to add domestic interpretations of IFRSs that are required for entities in that jurisdiction? That issue, I think, and it struck me, for example, in your slide that talks about you made an assumption that the EU responses counted as representative of the 27 member states, and to the best of my knowledge, the answer on my question is different amongst the 27 member states. And if for the purposes of dealing with the operation of the Interpretations Committee and getting a handle on what's going on out there, so first off, does it happen? Is there a process? And have they used it yet? I think would be a particularly interesting piece of information for the consistency question.
Thank you, Tricia. Of course, the survey was the first time we did it, and we do intend to have more surveys in the future. I think to just have more information as we go. This is the initial start. I'm sure we skipped some important stuff, so it's also a good opportunity to hear what would you be interested in, or what do you think we should be interested in. So it's a good contribution. Thank you. Any other comment?
In the second row at the end, the man in the... You had a question as well in the red tie. Sorry, I can't
say. Okay, thank you. No, I just wanted to find out the survey. You said a few countries have not given the survey yet, but once it's done, how would we get to know the final results of the survey, just to get a feel of what's the global perspective?
Sure. So,
thank you.
I mean, we have now, as I said, I think what we are doing now, we are doing the more detailed analysis with all the results that we have received up to the 15th of October. So that will be the 71, and I had a couple of submissions a few days later, so we will include those. But I think in parallel to doing that in-depth analysis, obviously the survey will be kept open, but the results of this batch will just come later. And I think the ideas, I mean, we need to obviously agree the details, is that obviously the jurisdictions that participated at least will receive a detailed question by question. But then what Yael said, the discussion was now.
This is actually what we want to know, because the options are either to have a more centralized information or to create a sort of an identity card for each country. So working with you, we have a formal source of information that could be found in our website on what's happening around the world. So there are no more inaccurate estimations, but a real source of information for everybody to know what's the situation in each country, and so that we can have direct contact, point of contact, so we can update that and verify that information. I think it could serve anyone, but this is what exactly we want to understand. how would you like to use that sort of database, and what would you be interested to see in that in the future? Yes.
Thank you. This is Youssef Al-Mubarak from Saudi Arabia. Thank you for all the effort has been made, and especially with that survey, I believe it's keeping everyone is updated what's going on. But you know, I really would like also encourage the ISP IFRS if they can further go in the survey to see the actual implementation of these standards. Now we have a yes and answer whether do you apply or not, but we would like to have an, if possible, independent reviewer who go and make sure that these financial statement, I mean, these standards has been prepared, has been implemented by the time when they say yes, implemented. I believe this kind of survey will add more trust in these financial statement. Thanks.
It's a very difficult thing to do that you're asking. You know, I think there is a lot of work going on at the ISB and the foundation to provide implementation support now. So thinking of ways that, you know, might fit with the survey to try and reinforce that implementation support, I think is a very good idea. But I think giving effect to some of those ideas can be very difficult.
May I comment? Yeah. I think one of the way to make it easy is to kind have kind of cooperation with the local institute to carry out this kind of survey. Then they can provide it with you. You cannot, of course, do everything, but at least there's a way that can be communicated. Also, you know, if you see the surveys all worldwide, you know, they have a lot of surveys with an independent organization being made. So this kind also of things can be looked for from either universities, from interested parties, association. This kind of association is independent most of the time. Accounting association, whatever, and any kind of any legal entity where it is in the country. When normally in the academic side specifically, when they go for this kind of research, they love this kind of things. So they can do it without any cost, and you will have the result of it. Thanks.
Perhaps one proxy is the IFRS sign-off in the audit report. Because most of the big firms have house views, and therefore if a country fell out of that house view, it would be reflected in the opinion. The key is whether the opinion says, are you IFRS compliant or not? And if it does say that, then I think the comfort is Norm would sign off you know, without actually checking.
Yes.
Thank you, Yael. It's not a question, it's just a suggestion. As some of you may be aware, there is an initiative that started at the UNCTAD-ISAR level 3 or 4 years ago called Capacity Building in Financial Reporting. I happen to be the chairman of that working group. We're going to meet in Geneva next week for 3 days to discuss the preliminary results. And there we address this specific issue under four different pillars. One of them is a convergence, de jure or de facto, and we also added another perspective, which is which are the action plans a specific jurisdiction intends to put in place in order to fill the gap. Perhaps the ISB, if not already partnering with ISAR, could consider some sort of support. I know that even some ISB staff members will be in Geneva next week, including the chairman of the trustees. And it might be an interesting idea to liaise with them.
Thank you very much. Thank you for this suggestion. Anyone else wants to add about this database, about its potential use in the future? Okay. Thank you very much for all of you. I think we're definitely expecting a very good development here with having more information on use of IFRS, and I hope whoever of you who have not participated yet will send us their submission soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Hans, Yael, Sonia, and Mike for this. I think I personally found the session extremely interesting. I learned quite a lot. I think the opportunity for each country or each jurisdiction that responded at this point to provide additional feedback is fruitful, is important for us, and also creates an incentives for the ones who didn't respond at up to this point to respond and contribute with that. It's very important. We are asked frequently about the IFRS implementation and the diversity of processes around the world. So it's important for us to learn and to have a clear understanding about the adoption in those jurisdictions. So we are a little bit ahead of schedules. That's good. It's although not compromising the quality of the discussion. So with that, I would like to invite Wayne Upton to come to the podium and talk about the activities of the Interpretation Committee. Please welcome Wayne.